The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Religion News Service, the Associated Press, and the New Yorker. First of all, an article published by the Religion News Service on the 17th of May and written by Catherine Post entitled, Hebrew Bible Purchased for $38.1 Million for Display at Jewish Museum. The Codex Sassoon, a late 9th or early 10th century book Sotheby's has dubbed the earliest, most complete copy of the Hebrew Bible, was sold for $38.1 million on May 17 to American Friends of the ANU, Museum of the Jewish People. It will become part of the museum's core exhibition and permanent collection in Tel Aviv, Israel, according to Sotheby's. The purchase of the Codex Sassoon was made possible through a donation of Alfred H. Moses, a former U.S. ambassador to Romania, and his family. It's one of the most expensive historical documents ever sold at auction, clocking in just below the $43.2 million U.S. Constitution, sold in November 2021 to art collector Ken Griffin. A $30.8 million collection of scientific writings from Leonardo da Vinci was bought by Bill Gates in 1994. The Hebrew Bible is the most influential book in history and constitutes the bedrock of Western civilization. I rejoice in knowing that it belongs to the Jewish people. It was my mission, realizing the historic significance of Codex Sassoon, to see that it resides in a place with global access to all people, Moses said in a press release. In my heart and mind, that place was the land of Israel, the cradle of Judaism, where the Hebrew Bible was originated. The Codex doesn't derive its value from the hundreds of sheepskins required for the parchment of the 26-pound book, the labor required to handwrite the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, or even necessarily the precision of the text itself. The Aleppo Codex, a Hebrew Bible manuscript created around 930, is known for its unparalleled quality. Instead, as V. Novick, who holds the Abrams Chair of Jewish Thought and Culture at the University of Notre Dame, Indiana, told RNS, the claim to fame of the Codex Sassoon lies in its combination of earliness and comprehensiveness. And Aaron Kohler, professor of Near Eastern and Biblical Studies at Yeshiva University, added, there is simply nothing else like it on the market. With other codices from that era already secured by museum collections. The carbon dating was really important for them because they had initially thought to offer it for a bit less until the carbon dating came back, plausibly around 900 CE, which would make it as early or even a little earlier than the Aleppo Codex, said Kohler. Though specifics about Codex Sassoon's origins are murky, experts date the biblical copy to roughly 1,100 years ago in Syria or Israel. In the 13th century, the Codex was dedicated to a synagogue in present-day Syria or Israel. In the 13th century, the Codex was later destroyed. It then vanished for roughly 600 years before resurfacing in 1929, when it was purchased for £350 by British collector and Hebrew manuscript enthusiast David Solomon Sassoon. Eventually, Swiss financier Jackie Safra purchased it for $4.2 million in 1989. For centuries, the Codex has been largely obscured from public view, but a global tour earlier this year brought the book to London, Tel Aviv, Dallas, Los Angeles, and New York City. Currently researching at Cambridge, Kohler was invited to view the Codex outside of its display case while it was being exhibited in London. We have names and places of this sort of trail of cultural patrimony as it's going around different communities, moving from country to country. It's gone on quite a journey, said Kohler. So to get to your hands, I find that very moving in terms of the artifact itself. The codex is inscribed with ownership records as well as commentary for preserving the proper recitation and inscription of the text. It's not written for liturgical performance. It's written for study. And it also could have been written as a model for scribes when scribes were writing scrolls of the Torah, said Novick. It's one of these texts that preserve the Masorah, literally the tradition. In the codex, Novick explained, the Masorah takes the form of notes in the margins and an annotation system that indicates the correct pronunciation and vocalization of the text. Hebrew was written only consonantally, so the project of preserving the vocalization of the text is a real challenge, Novick added. According to Kohler, the text of Codex Sassoon would have emerged in an Islamic cultural context. He said that because of Arabic, like Hebrew, is written with consonants, Muslims invented a system of dots to mark vowels and to transmit to a reader everything you need to know to read accurately. It was only around the 9th century, Kohler said, that Jewish communities began writing whole Bibles using a similar system. He added that exposure to the artistic and sacred Arabic script used throughout the Muslim world may have also informed the scribe who authored Codex Sassoon. The aesthetic sensibility is, first of all, it's new, and I think it's also the effect of Islam in the world of biblical manuscripts, said Kohler, who pointed to the beautiful writing, the high-quality parchment, and the way many of the pages are framed by notes in the margins. This is a new way of thinking about a text as something that's not just pragmatic, but can actually be artistic. In interviews before the auction, both Kohler and Novick expressed hopes that the codex would be able to be viewed by the public after it was sold. According to Irina Nevslin, chair of ANU's board of directors, that wish is being granted. We will be eternally grateful to Ambassador Moses and his family for ensuring that the most treasured, historic, and complete Bible in existence will be permanently displayed at the world's largest Jewish museum, she said in a statement. Now an article published by the Associated Press on May 24, entitled Priest Killed in Mexico, Ninth Slain in Country in Past 4 Years, Mexico City. A Roman Catholic priest has been killed in the western Mexican state of Michoacan, the ninth slain in the country in the past 4 years. The church's Catholic Multimedia Center identified the priest as Reverend Javier Garcia Villafana, who had been assigned to the Capacho Parish in Juan de Carrillo just 1 month earlier. The Michoacan State Prosecutor's Office said that Garcia's body had several gunshot wounds and was found inside a vehicle. The killing came 1 day after the Mexican Episcopal Conference expressed its solidarity and condemnation of an attack against Monsignor Faustino Armendariz Jimenez, Archbishop of the northern state of Durango. On Sunday, an elderly man tried to stab Armendariz in Durango's cathedral. The archbishop escaped uninjured. The conference condemned Garcia's killing in a statement and called on authorities to find those responsible. It is a painful reminder of the serious situation we face as a society, in which the presence of organized crime and impunity continue threatening the lives and safety of so many, the statement said. The Catholic Multimedia Center said in the statement that Garcia was shot while driving near Capacho on the shores of Cuitzillo. Michoacan has been roiled by violence for years. Multiple drug cartels vie for control of parts of the state and extend their illicit business to logging, mining, and even limes and avocados. In their quest to eliminate any threat to their operations, organized criminal groups have killed journalists, environmental activists, and priests, in addition to any average citizens caught in the way. Gangs have taken complete control of some communities. In 2021, a priest in Michoacan called for parishioners to arm themselves in the face of governmental inaction. The cartel gunmen come. They take the livestock. They screw your wife and daughter, and you do nothing, the Reverend Alfredo Galago said in a sermon. Well, get yourself a gun. The government can go to hell. Galagos, a parish priest, is better known as Father Pistolas for his habit of carrying a gun. The Mexican government in recent years has done little more than send troops to act as a buffer between warring cartels in Michoacan. More generally, the church in Mexico has displayed great frustration with the country's security situation. After a drug gang leader in the northern state of Chihuahua killed two elderly Jesuit priests and a tour guide inside a church in Cerro Cahui last June, the Roman Catholic Mexican Council of Bishops issued an open letter telling the government, it is time to revise the security policies that are failing. Now an article from the Religion News Service, published on May 16, written by Bob Smetana, entitled, Cyber Fraud Cost Florida Baptist More Than $700,000. Staff at the Florida Baptist Convention thought they were sending missionary money to help pay for church planting. Then the money disappeared. The Florida Baptist Convention continues to work with federal and state investigators, our internal and external auditors, to recover over $700,000 in funds stolen from the convention through cyber targeting, according to an update on the convention's website on May 15. Florida Baptist officials first announced they'd been a victim of fraud on May 10, but had not shared the scope of the loss. The announcement on the convention's website was updated after RNS asked leaders at the convention to confirm the size of the loss. The Florida Baptists are one of more than 40 state conventions affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention. The funds were meant to go to the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention, which partners with the Florida Baptist on church planting. That process was interrupted when the Florida Baptist staff received an email that claimed to be from NAMB, but was not, and requested funds be sent to a new account number. The fraudulent email reflected a general knowledge of the communications and practice between the SBC entity and the convention. An investigation is being launched to determine how this knowledge was gained, the convention said in a statement. At this time, we have no reason to suspect malfeasance by any convention employees. Convention leaders said they will honor their commitment to support churches and other ministries despite the loss by drawing on reserves. They also said they would add to their cybersecurity, which according to leaders already included training, regular information systems upgrades, and advanced detection software. They also warn churches about the ongoing danger of cybercrime. These types of attacks continue to plague organizations of all sizes and scopes, the convention said in a statement. We encourage pastors and churches to remain diligent with the security of their IT and financial systems. This specifically includes critically scrutinizing any and all requests, even those from a supposedly well-known source, that request a shift from historical payment practices. Mike Ebert, a spokesman for the NAMB, said that agency adheres to robust cyber and data security protocols, follows best-in-class accounting principles and internal controls to protect donations from Southern Baptist. We have and will continue to support our ministry partners as they seek to do the same, Ebert said. Earlier this year, a church in North Carolina reportedly lost close to $800,000 after receiving a fraudulent email. The Reverend Johnny Blevins, pastor of Elkin Valley Baptist Church, told a North Carolina television station the church received an email bill from a contractor working on the church building. Immediately following that email was another email, which we thought was from Landmark, Blevins told the television station. It had been cloned, basically, from that email, and it gave instructions on payment and included the invoice and everything. The fraud was reportedly discovered when the contractor called, asking about the unpaid bill. A GoFundMe campaign to replace some of the North Carolina church losses has raised $7,761, far short of the $793,848 goal. Recovering any funds will likely be a drawn-out process, as the United Church of Marco Island, a Florida Gulf Coast congregation, has discovered. The church lost $1.2 million to fraud in March 2022. About half of the money was recovered, but the church's insurance company declined to cover any of the church's losses, saying the church policy did not cover impersonation fraud, according to a complaint against the insurer filed by the church in state court. The case was recently moved to a federal court in Florida. John Hughes III, the attorney who represents the church, declined to discuss the specifics of how the fraud occurred. But he did say many of the cases of cyber fraud affecting churches are similar, often involving fake phishing emails. Those emails are often created, he said, by taking a real email and cutting and pasting its contents, including email signatures. Hughes warned that churches and businesses need to be wary because of the relentless efforts of fraudsters, especially when it comes to finances. Any instructions that come by email, they need to confirm them via phone mail, he said. Otherwise, he added, they just wire the money out and it's gone. He essentially warned of the need for care in dealing with familiar financial transactions, where people might be tempted to click send without reading the entire email. Hughes also suggested churches and other groups be proactive in talking to their insurance company about fraud. He argued that in the case of the Marco Island Church, the loss should be covered, but the process of recovering losses, he said, will be long. The church's insurance company did not respond to a request for comment. Florida Baptists hope that some of the losses will be recovered. We remain prayerful that some of the loss may be mitigated through insurance and or the recovery of stolen funds, the convention's update states. Now an article from the Associated Press, published on May 17, written by Nicole Winfield and entitled, New Head of Vatican Charity Caritas Looks to Future After Papal Firings, Vatican City. The new head of Caritas Internationalis said May 17 that the Vatican's preeminent charity would look to the future of its global aid mission, seeking to close out a tumultuous period that prompted Pope Francis to oust the previous leadership team. The Vatican presented the charity's new hierarchy following elections by representatives of the 162 national Caritas chapters who met in Rome. It was the first General Assembly since Francis in November removed the Caritas president, vice presidents, secretary general, treasurer, and ecclesiastic assistant after an outside investigation into bullying complaints found management problems at the Rome headquarters. The new Secretary General, Alistair Dutton, acknowledged the chapter representatives had questions about the Pope's unusual intervention and that he himself feared walking into an assembly where people were angry and frustrated and were looking backward. But he said the spirit of the meeting was instead one of a family looking to learn from the past and move forward. "I know the past is there, but we really haven't dwelt on it," Dutton told reporters. "We've been trying to look now to the future." Dutton, a British former Jesuit novice, spoke alongside the new Caritas president, Tokyo Archbishop Tasiako Isaho Kiyuchi, who has become the treasurer Patrick du Bouquois of Belgium, and Christy Robertson, who becomes the organization's first woman vice president. Robertson, head of the Caritas Australia branch, said it was particularly significant for a woman to hold the position that represents Caritas in official Catholic Church events that are often dominated by male clerics. "The face of poverty is the face of a woman," she told reporters. "Therefore, it is only right and just, I think, to see the face of women at all levels in our confederation." Dutton acknowledged that there's also been a concerted search for a woman from the Global South to head the organization as Secretary General. But he said he heard from national representatives who voted for him, including delegates who had pushed for a woman head, that he had the skills necessary to get the job done. Dutton replaces Aloysius John, a French citizen of Indian descent, who was ousted in November after staff at the Caritas headquarters complained of a toxic work environment. On the eve of the General Assembly, John accused the Vatican of staging a brutal power grab fueled by a colonialist attitude of northern wealthy Caritas chapters over poorer ones in the developing country, in the developing world. In a sign that the Global South had not fully moved on, John's ecclesiastic assistant, who was also ousted in November, the Reverend Pierre Chibambo, was elected by African Caritas leaders to be their regional Caritas African representative. Dutton said he viewed the election as a marker being put down by Africa to keep Chibambo in a leadership position, but that he did not anticipate problems. Now an excerpt from an article published by The New Yorker magazine on May 29 and written by Nick Palmgarten in Plain Sight. Kyle Berlin was recently recollecting the genesis of an idea. "Every student I knew was in some way or another anxious or depressed, and I'm not sure why. It still baffles me." This was 5 years ago, well before the pandemic, and at Princeton University, a rarefied realm of how could this be? Berlin, from Arroyo Grande, California, was the valedictorian of the class of 2018. He often met at 8 a.m. under a Korean dogwood tree on campus, with his chaplain, Matthew Weiner, the school's associate dean of religious life, known to students as Dean Matt. They'd been battling around the question of compassion and how to cultivate it in a high-powered setting, where the emphasis seemed always to be on matters of excellence, performance, efficiency, and survival. Institutions do not, as a matter of course, perpetuate kindness. One morning, Weiner told Berlin about something he'd noticed at lunch the day before. The woman responsible for swiping the diner's meal cards had been smiling and chattering with students as they filed by, converting a glum procession into a buoyant parade. Dean Matt thought, "She's doing my job." "That's Catalina," Berlin said. He'd known her since freshman year. "She's a hidden chaplain," he added. He named a couple of others. Hidden chaplain, this then would be the term they'd use for staff members who, in their regular encounters, brighten students' days. This unwitting ministry combined elements of angelic supervision, parental nurturing, and what Berlin called quietly glorious acts of caring. They printed up postcards, "Who is your hidden chaplain?" and distributed them in a surreptitious way around campus. Nominations poured in, and a new tradition, in a place already thick with old ones, was born. "I really appreciated the organic and rogue informality of it," Berlin said. Earlier this month, the hidden chaplains were summoned to a now annual banquet at Murray Dodge Hall, the religious life headquarters. There were about 100 celebrants, some 50 hidden chaplains plus their guests, and about half as many students. 119 students had submitted names. Catalina Maldonado Lopez, the Catalina, sat in a corner with her daughter Gloria. She wore a blue button-down and jeans. "I met Kyle in 2014. He asked me, 'How do you have so much energy?' And I said, 'If I don't talk to you guys, I'll feel your sadness. My job is very simple. It's boring if you don't talk. I'm just a mama with 5 kids, and I feel like these kids are part of my kids. Their mama's not here. You see this crazy woman? I hope my crooked smile is making you happy." Nearby, 3 other hidden chaplains from dining services, Jacqueline Davis, Moo Moo Pui, and Thomas Stallone, sat with Rosemilin Jerez, a senior from Miami, who had nominated Stallone. He had worked his way up from pot scrubber to cook in a university kitchen. And now, in semi-retirement, he, like Catalina, was swiping meal cards. "The students put a lot of confidence in me," he said. "I don't have kids of my own. It makes me feel, I hate to use the word important, valued," Pui said. "It's precious, the acknowledgement," Davis said. "And I think it makes the students feel great to do something for the staff." We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.